You're listening to the new security broadcast from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. In this episode, we share remarks made by Pakistan's Foreign Minister, His Excellency Bilawal Bhutto Zardari, at an event hosted by the Wilson Center's Asia Program earlier this week. The floods that have hit Pakistan this summer are the worst in the country's recorded history. More than 1,500 people have been killed and tens of thousands have been displaced. The long-term implications of the crisis are daunting. As the foreign minister says, the Pakistani people know monsoons and they know floods. But a change in climate means changing realities for a country that has contributed just a fraction of a percentage of greenhouse gas emissions.
It's a pleasure to be here at the Wilson Institute today. I believe when we planned to be at the United Nations and to follow up with our bilateral trip in Washington, D.C., our agenda perhaps would have been different. But by the time I was making my way to the United States, the ground realities in Pakistan had fundamentally shifted. As a speaker before me noted, these are no normal monsoons and no normal floods. We are used to monsoons. We are used to floods. We have provincial mechanisms, national mechanisms to deal with such disaster. What we were not prepared for was for floods to descend from the sky, to form such a large body of water in the middle of our country that could literally be seen from space, and that is still eking its way to the ocean, leaving devastation in its wake. How does one overnight cater to the needs of 33 million people, greater than the population of Sri Lanka, New Zealand, Australia, 95% of Canada, more than the people in all of New York State? And this is a compounding tragedy. We're still in the rescue and relief phase, but we see how this is going to get a lot more difficult. Because not only do we have the immediate destruction of the floods, that, as I mentioned, 33 million people, 16 million children, 600,000 pregnant women waiting to give birth. But now with this massive body of water that'll take many months to either descend into the sea or evaporate, we're looking at, as the WHO has warned, a second catastrophe, a health catastrophe, with waterborne diseases spreading at epidemic rates and our supplies of basics like Panadol and anti-malaria medication not being able to keep up. And if the 33 million people have been affected, I mean, if you've seen the images, I'm sure there's been videos on social media, etc., of the masses of mosquitoes rising from these waters and forming large clouds above, it is truly an apocalyptic scene. Now, not only do we have the flood climate catastrophe, the health disaster, but at least 4 million plus acres of standing crop or cash crop was destroyed in these floods. The income of small farmers, which is largely agricultural areas where we have been affected. And one often looks at the images on TV, particularly from far away, and there's this impression that these are all incredibly, you know, impoverished people, and absolutely Pakistan has a problem with poverty. But I must explain that amongst those 33 million people, the large majority of which were not impoverished before the floods. They were earning their way. They were taking care of their families, of the earnings of their lands. Now they are homeless and impoverished. And the devastation on the standing crops mean that now we're going to face food insecurity. We all know we were anyway threatened with that because of Ukraine and supply line issues. Now this is a serious threat. And anybody who's been following Pakistan particularly closely while all of this was happening, they'll know that we were in a very difficult, like everybody else is in a very difficult economic situation, but we were in a particularly perilous economic situation because of some decisions that had been taken in violation of IMF program that had that our finance minister was in record as saying as, you know, so Pakistan was in danger of default. And we had managed to pull us back from the brink and get our second tranche, sorry, not second tranche, agree to the new tranche and extension from the IMF. And that money literally came in the middle of August as the rains were descending. But all those estimates, all those figures might as well have been washed away with the floods as well. So we're staring at an incredibly difficult economic situation as well. Now, as the speaker before me mentioned, the people of Pakistan are incredibly resilient. We have time and time, in fact, they've been far more resilient than they need to be. But this is not a crisis of their making. We contribute, Pakistan, 0.8% of the global carbon footprint. And literally, the 33 million people of Pakistan are paying in the form of their lives, in the form of their livelihoods, for global warming that they didn't create. So as the UN Secretary General has stated, this is not about charity. This is about economic justice. And we've heard time and time again about how the country I'm standing in, Europe, all the great powers are combating climate change, are not only taking climate change so seriously themselves, but are championing the cause around the world. We hear about the Green Climate Fund and $100 billion annual commitment to fight climate change. Well, guess what? When your country is drowning in a 100-kilometer lake and a third of the landmass of your country is underwater, you find out there's no money. There's no international financial infrastructure to deal with the calamity of this scale. There is the loss and damage is a conversation we're still debating about happening. And that is incredibly frustrating. But now this is the opportunity in this crisis. That Pakistan's message is that it is us today, it could be anybody else tomorrow. And while we work to ensure we get the funds for our rescue and relief, while we have a clear vision about how we don't only want to reconstruct our reconstruction and rehabilitation place to take place, but we want to do so in a climate-resistant manner, a greener manner. Yes, we too aspire to build back better. So while we have that clear vision and we engage with international financial institutions and there's novel ideas to discuss with, rather than the great powers, we should say the great polluters, to discuss with the great polluters about debt swap and other mechanisms that may help us here and now, what we have to do is ensure that while there was no script for us, while there was no ready-made plan for us, that the next time this happens to some other country, we are more prepared. And in our country, in our efforts to bring our people to stand on their own feet, for our country to stand on their own feet, we commit ourselves, because we would have never otherwise had such extensive investment in all of these areas that have been devastated by the floods. And now there are two options for us. Either we do it cheaply and poorly and dirtily and wait for the next floods for them to be washed away again. Or we do it right. We become the test case, the leaders, for what we've heard and so only heard about the great, about this green infrastructure, climate resilient infrastructure. And I honestly believe that domestically and internationally now, whatever our political preoccupations are, we have to understand the gravity of the situation. Before these floods, this was tomorrow's problem for us. We were working on green energy and solar energy and wind energy. And yeah, not everything's great, but we'd get there. And we'd seen historic floods that were devastating before, but we cope, we got over them. Now there's an urgency. There's an urgency of now. And I don't wish upon anybody else to discover this urgency in the manner that we've discovered it today. So whether it's our domestic politics in Pakistan that is incredibly highly polarized, that too needs to accept the gravity of the situation and rise to the challenge. But in the international geopolitical space as well, we have to ask ourselves what history will say of the choices that humanity made when they were faced with an existential threat. We saw how during the COVID pandemic, a once in a 100-year COVID pandemic that is still not over, that we did not rise to the challenge. It would have been incredibly inspirational if we had seen the President of the United States stand with the President in China and announce how we, as the human race, would defeat this existential threat. Unfortunately, we were arguing over whether it was the Wuhan virus or the China virus and how fascist it was for us to wear masks or to do lockdowns. And we suffered as a result, and we are still suffering as a result. We have a climate catastrophe that is spiraling out of control. The 10 most climate-stressed countries, out of which Pakistan is one, have contributed negligibly to the overall carbon footprint, but they are going to be the frontline victims. And this is what history will ask us, that while our planet was burning, while we were being warned time and time again, from Gore to Greta, that the climate is in imminent danger, do we choose to ignite new conflicts, provoke new tensions, busy ourselves with the conflicts of man? Or did we rise to this occasion? And let me be absolutely clear. We will not overcome climate change. We will not save our planet if China and the United States do not work together on climate. Everything else can wait. Every other conflict, every other dispute. We'll all fight amongst ourselves if there's a planet left to fight over. Up until then, there needs to be an awakening that this is the time for unity. This is the time for multilateralism. This is not the time for war. Imagine the carbon footprint of Ukraine. I mean, this is an absolutely, I can't condemn, but farcical series of events. You can't lecture on climate, on green energy, on how we must work together while we continue to engage in conflicts. And I honestly have insisted and will continue to insist that the path to peace is through dialogue and diplomacy. The catastrophes that we are facing, the challenges that we are facing, are truly that of a global making, and surely the solutions are also global.
You've been listening to the New Security Broadcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.